Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is November 24th, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Die Trying, Intubation of In-Hospital Cardiac Arrests. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Robert Edmonds. He is an emergency physician in the U.S. Air Force. He is currently deployed, practicing emergency medicine in an undisclosed location. This is his fifth visit to the SGEM. Welcome back, Bob.
Hey, Ken. I made it to number five, our favorite number. I'm working abroad currently, and on behalf of all of us here, we send a warm welcome back home to our families. We hope Thanksgiving was great, and we really wish we could have been there.
Well, Bob, thank you for your service, especially over the holidays, but you do need to give us a disclaimer before we get started.
Yes, Ken. Everything I say is not anyone else's opinion. The views and opinions of this podcast do not represent the United States government or the United States Air Force.
Good. We got that out of the way right up front. Okay, give us a case.
Sure thing. You are working a regular shift in the emergency department when you hear a code blue called. You are the first physician to respond and you begin to resuscitate the patient. Your respiratory therapist is adequately ventilating the patient with a bag valve mask and they ask you if they should prepare to intubate at the pulse and rhythm check.
Well, Bob, we've talked a lot about out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, or OCAs, many times on the SGEM.
Yeah, now this time, as the case identifies, we're going to be talking about in-hospital cardiac arrest today.
Well, the American Heart Association, or the AHA, reports that there are over 200,000 in-hospital cardiac arrests in 2016. And the survival rate for adults to hospital discharge is about 25%.
The survival rate for in-hospital cardiac arrests, or IHCA, has almost doubled from the year 2000 when it was only 13.7%. From a patient-oriented outcome perspective, more than 80% of adults with IHCA who do survive end up having a favorable neurologic outcome at discharge. This is defined as a cerebral performance category score of 1 or 2.
Well, there are five, that's right, Bob, five steps in the AHA in-hospital cardiac arrest chains of survival. And step one is surveillance and prevention. So that means monitoring, anticipating, and preventing.
Step two is recognition and activation of the emergency response system. Hey, I think they just arrested, and call the code.
Step three, immediate high-quality CPR. Now, the AHA makes a big deal about how fast and how deep. I really don't think we have robust data on the exact precision. But you know what? Get the CPR started.
Absolutely. Step four, rapid defibrillation for those with a shockable rhythm.
And the fifth and final step, this is the advanced life support and post-arrest care. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today, specifically tracheal intubation.
Sudden IHCA is a high-stakes emergency with a high mortality rate. The decision to intubate is difficult to make and varies widely between clinicians. Due to the nature of intubation and cardiac arrest, it's difficult to study, and the studies that do exist are largely observational.
Until this paper, there were no studies of in-hospital cardiac arrest intubations and survival. So give us the clinical question.
Does tracheal intubation during adult in-hospital cardiac arrest affect survival?
And the reference?
Anderson et al., Association Between Tracheal Intubation During Adult In-Hospital Cardiac Arrest and Survival in JAMA 2017.
Okay, what was the population?
Adult patients 18 years of age and older with an index cardiac arrest for which they received chest compressions.
And they defined cardiac arrest as pulselessness requiring chest compressions and or defibrillation with a hospital-wide or unit-based emergency response.
There were a few exclusions. If you had a do not resuscitate order, already having an advanced airway in place, such as a tracheal tube, tracheostomy, laryngeal mask airway, or other invasive airways other than oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal airways, also exclude were patients missing data other than race.
And what was the exposure?
Tracheal intubation, including either a tracheal tube or a tracheostomy tube during the cardiac arrest.
And unsuccessful intubation attempts were not logged as intubations in the registry. What did they compare it to?
Patients who did not receive tracheal intubation.
All right, let's go through the primary and secondary outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
survival to hospital discharge.
And the secondary outcome?
Return of spontaneous circulation and favorable neurologic outcome at hospital discharge with a CPC score of 1 or 2.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, among adult patients with in-hospital cardiac arrest, initiation of tracheal intubation within any given minute during the first 15 minutes of resuscitation compared with no intubation during that minute was associated with decreased survival to hospital discharge. Although the study design does not eliminate the potential for confounding by indication, these findings do not support early tracheal intubation for adult in-hospital cardiac arrest. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for observational studies. The first question, did this study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes.
Did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
Yes. Their question was about associations. Quote, to determine whether tracheal intubation during adult in-hospital cardiac arrest is associated with survival to hospital discharge.
Did they recruit the cohort in an acceptable way?
Yes.
Question 4, was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
It's a little bit unsure. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
I'm unsure.
How was the follow-up? Was it complete?
Yes.
How precise is the estimate of risk?
It was precise with tight 95% confidence intervals.
Do you believe the results?
Yes.
Can you apply the results to your local population?
Yes.
And the last question, do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
Yes. The data on this topic is limited, but it fits with a prior Japanese study on out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and intubation.
All right, let's go through the key results here. The cohort included over 100,000 adult patients from almost 700 U.S. hospitals. 42% were female, the median age was 69 years, and the overall survival rate to hospital discharge was 22.4%. How about the primary outcome, though?
Survival was 16.3% with intubation versus 19.4% without intubation. Now, this bears some discussion. The overall cohort included the 108,000 patients, and the survival rate was 22.4%. Both the intubation and, quote, not intubated groups had survival less than this number. This is due to their matching process, which we'll discuss shortly.
All right, and just to dive down into that primary outcome a little bit more, the survival to hospital discharge was lower in patients who were intubated versus those who were not intubated, and it gave you a relative risk of 0.84. How about the secondary outcomes?
There was less ROSC and less discharge with good neurologic function in the intubated patients.
And we'll put details in the show notes, but Bob, it's time to talk nerdy to me. And we've got how many points? Come on, Bob. Give it to me.
Magic number five.
All right. So I've got the first one, and that's the study design. And given the observational cohort study design, we can only conclude an inverse association between intubation and survival to hospital discharge, not causation.
Number two is the decision to intubate. The key to the entire study was the decision to intubate or not. It is difficult to ascertain what factors lead some physicians to intubate patients in cardiac arrest. For some doctors, all patients in arrest get intubated. Others decide to intubate more selectively for a myriad of reasons. The decision-making for this intervention is unable to be derived from the study due to its retrospective nature.
The third point is about propensity matching. This has been referred to by my friend, Dr. Mark Abel, as statistical jiu-jitsu. Others have called it statistical gymnastics. Regardless of the term you use, it's impossible to account for all the potential confounders. Now, to their credit, the authors put this limitation right in their conclusion.
Now, let's dig into that a little bit further. The authors use an interesting technique to match cases. Patients who were intubated were then matched with cases that, at that time in resuscitation, were not intubated. The authors specifically state that for these matched, not intubated patients, many of them, 68% of them actually, were later intubated.
And this has the potential to introduce bias, as these cases for matching were sometimes intubated versus at risk of being intubated later, rather than intubated versus never intubated.
Our fourth point is on respiratory insufficiency. A major argument that intubation is needed in sudden cardiac arrest patients is that they suffered from respiratory insufficiency prior to arrest. In the author's subgroup analysis, pre-existing respiratory insufficiency showed no association with survival, while the patients without pre-existing respiratory insufficiency showed lower likelihood of survival if they were intubated. However, since the comparison was intubated at time X versus at risk of being intubated at time X, this argument is muddied, since essentially you have a group of 43,000 patients who were intubated versus a group that's a combination of 32% patients that were never intubated and 68% patients who were intubated at some time later than the first group.
And the fifth and final thing was about the exclusion. One quarter of patients, almost 35,000 of all eligible in-hospital cardiac arrest patients who met all the inclusion criteria, were excluded. This was due to missing data. Now, they did sensitivity analysis to account for the missing data. However, with such a small effect size for the primary outcome after propensity score matching, it was 3%, it makes me skeptical of the results. All right, that's it. That's enough talking nerdy. Let's get on to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we generally agree that the findings show an association that does not support early tracheal intubation for adult IHCA patients.
Give us a bottom line then.
We should continue to use our clinical judgment and be selective with who we intubate during a cardiac arrest.
And how about a case resolution?
So you tell your respiratory therapist not to intubate and to continue to use the bag valve mask. At your pulse check, the patient is in ventricular fibrillation. You defibrillate them with 200 joules and resume CPR. At the next pulse check, the patient has ROSC and you transfer them to the ICU.
So Bob, how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically then?
Well, Ken, given the data, it appears reasonable to continue to be selective with intubation in sudden cardiac arrest. This data is not strong enough to really have an impact on my care. There may be some patients, especially those with respiratory insufficiency, that would derive benefit from intubation during their arrest.
A randomized control trial, though, is needed to answer that question, to intubate or not to intubate in the adult in-hospital cardiac arrest patient. This observational cohort study suggests equipoise and could be used to request ethics approval for an RCT. What are you going to tell your patient?
Well, as my patient is currently actively dying, I don't tell them anything. But if my staff asks while coding the patient, I'll tell them that unless the patient becomes difficult to ventilate with the bag valve mask, we'll hold off on intubation for now.
It's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Jardin Dichiaco, an FNP student from Valencia, California. They knew haloperidol was discovered by Paul Janssen, who ended up having a pharmaceutical company named after him. What's the Keener question this week, Bob?
Intubation of the trachea, rather than the more invasive tracheotomy, was first described by a French pediatrician for what disease?
Ooh, if you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem at gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. That first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there are some other FOMED resources on this paper, and I will list them in the show notes. But thank you, Bob, for coming back on the SGEM and helping us spread some FOMED.
No problem. I'm happy to do it, Ken. I'm looking forward to our next review. I'd like to point out that regardless of our discussion of papers, research is hard to do, and we greatly appreciate the author's work on furthering the science of our field.
Agreed. It is hard to do research and get it published, and I hope these critical appraisals are never ad hominem attacks, but rather just a review of the science. And in the process, SGEMers learn critical appraisal skills. The KT window is decreased to less than 1 year, and patients get the best care based on the best evidence. Well, Bob, stay safe at your secret undisclosed location, and we look forward to your sixth appearance on the SGEM.
Thanks, Ken. I sure will. Emergency medicine faces unique challenges when you're far from home, but having colleagues to lean on has been super helpful.
Well, Bob, it's time to say the SGEM tagline. Now, usually I get the guest to say it in whatever accent they have or potentially another language. You being in the Air Force, I wonder if you could give the tagline in your best military voice.
Remember, skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptical Guide to Mercy Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. It takes four.